Chapter 13. The young Lord Berkeley, with the fresh air of freedom in his nostrils, was feeling invincibly strong for his new career. And yet, if the fight should prove a very hard one at first, very discouraging, very taxing on untoughened moral sinews, he might in some weak moment want to retreat. Not likely, of course, but possibly that might happen. And so on the whole it might be pardonable caution to burn his bridges behind him. Oh, without doubt. He must not stop with advertising for the owner of that money, but must put it where he could not borrow from it himself, meantime, under stress of circumstances. So he went downtown and put in his advertisement, then went to a bank and handed in the $500 for deposit. What name? He hesitated and colored a little. He had forgotten to make a selection. He now brought out the first one that suggested itself. Howard Tracy. When he was gone, the clerks, marveling, said. The cowboy blushed. The first step was accomplished. The money was still under his command, and at his disposal, but the next step would dispose of that difficulty. He went to another bank, and drew upon the first bank for the $500 by check. The money was collected, and deposited a second time to the credit of Howard Tracy. He was asked to leave a few samples of his signature, which he did. Then he went away, once more proud, and of perfect courage, saying, No help for me now, for henceforth I couldn't draw that money without identification, and that has become legally impossible. No resources to fall back on. It is work, or starve from now to the end. I am ready and not afraid. Then he sent this cablegram to his father. Escaped unhurt from burning hotel. Have taken fictitious name. Goodbye. During the evening while he was wandering about in one of the outlying districts of the city, he came across a small brick church, with a bill posted there with these words printed on it: : Mechanics Club Debate. All invited. He saw people, apparently mainly of the working class, entering the place, and he followed and took his seat. It was a humble little church, quite bare as to ornamentation. It had painted pews without cushions, and no pulpit, properly speaking, but it had a platform. On the platform sat the chairman, and by his side, sat a man who held a manuscript in his hand, and had the waiting look of one who is going to perform the principal part. The church was soon filled with a quiet and orderly congregation of decently dressed and modest people. This is what the chairman said. The essayist for this evening is an old member of our club whom you all know, Mr. Parker, assistant editor of the Daily Democrat. The subject of his essay is the American press, and he will use as his text a couple of paragraphs taken from Mr. Matthew Arnold's new book. He asks me to read these texts for him. The first is as follows. He says somewhere that the thrill of awe, that is to say, reverence, is the best thing humanity has. Mr. Arnold's other paragraph is as follows. I should say that, if one were searching for the best means to efface and kill in a whole nation the discipline of respect, one could not do better than take the American newspapers. Mr. Parker rose and bowed, and was received with warm applause. He then began to read in a good round resonant voice, with clear enunciation and careful attention to his pauses and emphasis. His points were received with approval as he went on. The essayist took the position that the most important function of a public journal in any country was the propagating of national feeling and pride in the national name, the keeping the people in love with their country and its institutions, and shielded from the allurements of alien and inimical systems. He sketched the manner in which the reverend Turkish or Russian journalist fulfilled this function, the one assisted by the prevalent discipline of respect for the bastinado, the other for Siberia. Continuing, he said, The chief function of an English journal is that of all other journals the world over. It must keep the public eye fixed admiringly upon certain things, and keep it diligently diverted from certain others. For instance, it must keep the public eye fixed admiringly upon the glories of England, a processional splendor stretching its receding line down the hazy vistas of time, with the mellowed lights of a thousand years glinting from its banners. And it must keep it diligently diverted from the fact that all these glories were for the enrichment and aggrandizement of the petted and privileged few, at cost of the blood and sweat and poverty of the unconsidered masses who achieved them, but might not enter in and partake of them. It must keep the public eye fixed in loving and awful reverence upon the throne as a sacred thing, and diligently divert it from the fact that no throne was ever set up by the unhampered vote of a majority of any nation, and that hence no throne exists that has a right to exist, and no symbol of it, flying from any flagstaff, is righteously entitled to wear any device but the skull and crossbones of that kindred industry which differs from royalty only business-wise merely as retail differs from wholesale. It must keep the citizen's eye fixed in reverent docility upon that curious invention of machine politics, an established church, and upon that bald contradiction of common justice, a hereditary nobility, and diligently divert it from the fact that the one damns him if he doesn't wear its collar, and drops him under the gentle name of taxation whether he wears it or not, and the other gets all the honors while he does all the work. The essayist thought that Mr. Arnold, with his trained eye and intelligent observation, ought to have perceived that the very quality which he so regretfully missed from our press, respectfulness, reverence, was exactly the thing which would make our press useless to us, if it had a drabbit of the very thing which differentiates it from all other journalism in the world, and makes it distinctively and preciously American, its frank and cheerful irreverence being by all odds the most valuable of all its qualities. Or its mission, overlooked by Mr. Arnold, is to stand guard over a nation's liberties, not its humbugs and shams. He thought that, if during 50 years the institutions of the old world could be exposed to the fire of a flouting and scoffing press like ours, monarchy and its attendant crimes would disappear from Christendom. Monarchists might doubt this. Then, why not persuade the Tsar to give it a trial in Russia? Concluding, he said, "Well, the charge is that our press has but little of that old world quality, reverence. Let us be candidly grateful that it is so. With its limited reverence it at least reveres the things which this nation reveres, as a rule, and that is sufficient. What other people revere is fairly and properly matter of light importance to us. Our press does not reverence kings, it does not reverence so-called nobilities, it does not reverence established ecclesiastical slaveries, it does not reverence laws which rob a younger son to fatten an elder one, it does not reverence any fraud or sham or infamy, howsoever old or rotten or holy, which sets one citizen above his neighbor by accident of birth. It does not reverence any law or custom, howsoever old or decayed or sacred, which shuts against the best man in the land the best place in the land, and the divine right to prove property, and go up and occupy it. In the sense of the poet Keith, that meek idolator of provincial 3-carat royalty and nobility, our press is certainly bankrupt in the rill of awe otherwise reverence. Reverence for nickel plate and brummagem. Let us sincerely hope that this fact will remain a fact forever. For to my mind a discriminating irreverence is the creator and protector of human liberty even as the other thing is the creator, nurse, and steadfast protector of all forms of human slavery, bodily and mental. Tracy said to himself, almost shouted to himself, "I'm glad I came to this country. I was right. I was right to seek out a land where such healthy principles and theories are in men's hearty and minds. Think of the innumerable slaveries imposed by misplaced reverence. How well he brought that out, and how true it is. There's manifestly prodigious force in reverence. If you can get a man to reverence your ideals, he's your slave. Oh, yes, in all the ages the peoples of Europe have been diligently taught to avoid reasoning about the shams of monarchy and nobility, been taught to avoid examining them, been taught to reverence them. and now, as a natural result, to reverence them as second nature. In order to shock them, it is sufficient to inject a thought of the opposite kind into their dull minds. For ages, any expression of, so dash called your reverence from their lips, has been sin and crime. The sham and swindle of all this is apparent the moment one reflects that he is himself the only legitimately qualified judge of what is entitled to reverence and what is not. Come, I hadn't thought of that before, but it is true, absolutely true. What right has Keith, what right has Arnold, what right has any dictionary to define the word your reverence for me? What their ideals are is nothing to me. So long as I reverence my own ideals, my whole duty is done, and I commit no profanation if I laugh at theirs. I may scoff at other people's ideals as much as I want to. It is my right and my privilege. No man has any right to deny it. Tracy was expecting to hear the essay debated, but this did not happen. The chairman said, by way of explanation, I would say, for the information of the strangers present here, that in accordance with our custom the subject of this meeting will be debated at the next meeting of the club. This is in order to enable our members to prepare what they may wish to say upon the subject with pen and paper, for we are mainly mechanics and unaccustomed to speaking. We are obliged to write down what we desire to say. Many brief papers were now read, and several offhand speeches made in discussion of the essay, read at the last meeting of the club, which had been a laudation, by some visiting professor, of college culture, and the grand results flowing from it to the nation. One of the papers was read by a man approaching middle age, who said he hadn't had a college education, that he had got his education in a printing office, and had graduated from there into the patent office, where he had been a clerk now for a great many years. Then he continued to this effect. The essayist contrasted the America of today with the America of bygone times, and certainly the result is the exhibition of a mighty progress. But I think he a little overrated the college culture share in the production of that result. It can no doubt be easily shown that the colleges have contributed the intellectual part of this progress, and that that part is vast, but that the material progress has been immeasurably vaster, I think you will concede. Now I have been looking over a list of inventors, the creators of this amazing material development, and I find that they were not college-bred men. Of course there are exceptions like Professor Henry of Princeton, the inventor of Mr. Morse's system of telegraphy, but these exceptions are few. It is not overstatement to say that the imagination-stunning material development of this century, the only century worth living in since time itself was invented, is the creation of men not college-bred. We think we see what these inventors have done. No, we see only the visible vast frontage of their work. Behind it is their far vaster work, and it is invisible to the careless glance. They have reconstructed this nation, made it over, that is, and metaphorically speaking, have multiplied its numbers almost beyond the power of figures to express. I will explain what I mean. What constitutes the population of a land? Merely the numberable packages of meat and bones in it called by courtesy men and women? Shall 1,000,000 ounces of brass and 1,000,000 ounces of gold be held to be of the same value? Take a truer standard. The measure of a man's contributing capacity to his time and his people, the work he can do, and then number the population of this country today, as multiplied by what a man can now do, more than his grandfather could do. By this standard of measurement, this nation, 2 or 3 generations ago, consisted of mere cripples, paralytics, dead men, as compared with the men of today. In 1840 our population was 17,000,000. By way of rude but striking illustration, let us consider, for argument's sake, that 4 of these millions consisted of aged people, little children, and other incapables, and that the remaining 13, 000,000 were divided and employed as follows. 2,000,000 as ginners of cotton. 6,000,000 women as stocking knitters. 2,000,000 women as thread spinners. 500,000 as screw makers. 400,000 as reapers, binders, etc. 1,000,000 as corn shellers. 40,000 as weavers. 1,000 as stitchers of shoe soles. Now the deductions which I am going to append to these figures may sound extravagant, but they are not. I take them from miscellaneous documents number 50, 2nd Session 45th Congress, and they are official and trustworthy. Today, the work of those 2,000,000 cotton ginners is done by 2,000,000 men, that of the 6,000,000 stocking knitters is done by 3,000 boys, that of the 2,000,000 thread spinners is done by 1,000 girls, that of the 500,000 screw makers is done by 500 girls, that of the 400,000 reapers, binders, etc., is done by 4,000 boys, that of the 1,000,000 corn shelters is done by 7,500 men, that of the 40,000 weavers is done by 1,200 men, and that of the 1,000 stitchers of shoe soles is done by 6 men. To bunch the figures, 17,900 persons today do the above work, whereas 50 years ago it would have taken 13 millions of persons to do it. Now then, how many of that ignorant race our fathers and grandfathers with their ignorant methods would it take to do our work today? It would take 40,000,800 times the swarming population of China, 20 times the present population of the globe. You look around you, and you see a nation of 60 millions apparently, but secreted in their hands and brains, and invisible to your eyes, is the true population of this republic, and it numbers 40 billions. It is the stupendous creation of those humble unlettered, uncollege-bred inventors, all honor to their name. How grand that is, said Tracy, as he wended homeward. Had a civilization it is, and what prodigious results these are, and brought about almost wholly by common men, not by Oxford-trained aristocrats, but men who stand shoulder to shoulder in the humble ranks of life, and earn the bread that they eat. Again, I'm glad I came. I have found a country at last, where one may start fair, and breast to breast with his fellow man, rise by his own efforts, and be something in the world, and be proud of that something, not be something created by an ancestor 300 years ago. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.